This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As if post-9/11 airport security lines, flight delays, cancellations, and lost luggage hadn't made flying challenging enough, now many of us have to figure out whether the airline we fly will still be in business by the time of our next trip. My guest, Scott McCartney, has covered the airline industry since 1995. He's the Wall Street Journal's travel editor and writes a consumer column about flying called The Middle Seat. We asked him for some explanations and advice. Let's start with a rundown of the airlines that are currently in bankruptcy.
United just passed its second anniversary in bankruptcy protection. U.S. Airways is currently in its second bankruptcy since 2001. ATA Airlines, which is based in Indianapolis and flies quite a bit out of Chicago, is a discount carrier in bankruptcy. And then both of the carriers based in Hawaii, interestingly, are in bankruptcy, Hawaiian and Aloha Airlines.
Let's talk a little bit about what this means for travelers and ticket buyers. Are any of these airlines likely to not be around in the next few weeks or the next few months? Like, if you're buying a ticket for a flight in March or April, are you safe?
I think you run a large risk on U.S. Airways. And I've written this, and it's a hard thing to write because you know the trouble with telling people not to buy tickets on a financially troubled carrier is that you just make the financial troubles worse. But in this case, U.S. Air still faces some big hurdles to get out of bankruptcy. It has jumped over the hurdles that it's faced so far, and may well continue to jump over hurdles. I think we'll know by the end of January, February or so, whether they're going to make it. Would I buy a ticket for this summer on U.S. Airways? No, I think I would wait and see. Fares are, plenty low. There's not a great need to rush into buying a ticket. If I was buying for summer travel, I'd buy elsewhere right now. If you have frequent flyer miles to redeem, and we've been saying this for a while, you can book tickets on U.S. Air partner airlines and give yourself a little protection that way. So book your ticket with U.S. Air miles on United or Lufthansa or Air Canada or one of the other Star Alliance partners, and you should be okay.
One suggestion you've made in your column that I think the discount airlines won't particularly like is that if you want to fly U.S. Air, buy your ticket, but also buy a backup ticket that's refundable. And I think those refundable tickets are usually the discount airlines.
Right, the discount airlines and even a non-refundable ticket on a discount airline carrier like Southwest has no penalty for changing a reservation. Mm-hmm. So you could actually cancel your reservation and have a credit on Southwest in the next year. It might be a smart thing to do if you think you sooner or later you're going to use the ticket for Southwest. If I was taking the family from Philadelphia to Orlando to Disney World or something like that, I think a backup plan, at spring break might be a good option.
If you are holding a ticket for an airline that goes under, what happens to the value of the ticket? Does the airline have any responsibility to reimburse you for it?
No, the airline doesn't, but the credit card company does. If the airline doesn't deliver the service that you paid for, then your credit card company has to give you a refund. Now, that's a good option for some people who can go buy a ticket somewhere else. If you bought a real cheap ticket for future travel and, the airline goes under the day before you're supposed to fly, you may not find that same fare. So your other option is to try and go standby on other airlines. There's a law in effect that says that airlines have to honor tickets of defunct carriers on a standby basis, and you have to pay a $50 fee. I think it's $25 each way. That's a good option if you get stranded, but again, if you've got a family of four and you're trying to get somewhere popular, trying to go on standby is a real nightmare.
Are you telling me that the credit card companies are the ones who have to bail out the passengers left with tickets from a carrier that went under?
Well, yes, because the credit card companies reserve for this kind of option. They hold back money from the airline. You may have paid. You write your check to the credit card company, and they may or may not have actually sent your dollars to the airline. They may still have the dollars. So, they're the ones under the Fair Credit Act that are responsible for this.
What's your analysis about why so many airlines are in bankruptcy now? How much of it is just soaring oil prices? How much of it is competition from the discount airlines? And how much of it is that they, did they get greedy?
Everything you mentioned is an important factor. And I think greed is really the biggest factor. The biggest mistake that the incumbent airlines ever made was not offering value to their customers, overcharging business travelers, gouging them. It's the old wallet biopsy. The corporation was willing to pay anything to get the guy to San Francisco to close the deal, and so the airlines were charging anything. And had fares not been so high, discount airlines wouldn't have had nearly the market that they had. They wouldn't have had nearly the growth opportunities that they've had. The legacy airlines, to a large extent, simply priced themselves out of a lot of markets. At the same time, the discount airlines had, the big advantage that they had was starting with a clean sheet of paper, with young workforces, young fleets, different work rules. The legacy airlines were really saddled with labor contracts, work rules, inefficiencies left over from the regulated days that they still haven't been able to shed. Mix all that with the internet, which I think was a tremendous driver of all this, which gave passengers the ability to shop around, to see airline prices. You know, it used to be if you wanted to go to New York, you called up the travel agent and said, I need to go to New York, and they'd say, when do you want to go? And you'd say, Friday at 5 p.m., and they'd say, here's the price. Now you can, in a matter of seconds, search all kinds of alternatives, see what, if going Thursday night is cheaper than Friday night or staying over or whatever, and it's all displayed very, very clearly for you. That gave consumers enormous power. Oil prices have hurt, all kinds of the economy's not helping airlines, and so it all created just a untenable situation for a lot of high-cost carriers.
I remember I was once on the phone buying a ticket from an airline, and the person on the phone selling the ticket explained to me that the reason why the major airlines charge so much more for tickets than the discount airlines was in part because the discount airlines only flew the most profitable routes, so they were never in a position of taking a loss on a route. Whereas the big airlines were not only flying the profitable routes, but they were flying a lot of the routes to like small towns where there was very little traffic, where they were probably going to lose money, but it was such an important service to their customers. Does that ring true to you?
Only partially. It's true that the discount airlines, being new to the business, essentially cherry-picked the routes that they think were the best routes. But they had the disadvantage that the legacy airlines had incredible advantages of having these big hubs at the major cities. The discount airlines have a hard time getting into Washington Reagan, which is a very important airport, very profitable for the legacy airlines. So partially true on that front. On the other end, on the small cities, small cities can be very profitable for big airlines if they have the right size equipment. And those cities, bring in a lot of travelers that allow them to operate big hubs. If you take out all the small cities from the feed traffic of the hub airlines, the whole thing is not nearly as profitable. One of the interesting developments recently is that the discount airlines are pushing more and more into smaller cities. Next fall, JetBlue Airways brings in a 100-seat jet, small, essentially a regional airline-sized jet, that they'll fly to smaller cities and start feeding their hub at JFK.
You mentioned the fares that took advantage of business travelers who were booking their reservations at the last minute, and those fares were much higher than the fares you would book if you were booking, say, a month in advance. Can you talk a little bit about how that kind of fare system came to be in the first place, where you have the long-term booking price and then it got much more expensive 14 days in advance and even more expensive 7 days in advance, and if you're booking the day before, wow. what was the rationale behind those different levels?
It was a way to segregate leisure travelers who are incredibly price sensitive from business travelers who aren't. It's the difference between if the ticket is being bought out of your wallet or your company's wallet. And the Saturday night stay was the key driver in all of that, because airlines figured, hey, you know, how can we figure out who's a leisure traveler and who's a business traveler? Well, we can do it by setting all these conditions. Business travelers, and I think this has changed too, but business travelers historically did not want to buy tickets far in advance. They didn't really know what their schedule might be 3 weeks from now. Leisure travelers did, because you would, you know, plan the vacation way in advance. Saturday night stay was another segregator. So all of these rules came into being as a way simply to separate price-sensitive travelers from non-price-sensitive travelers. And if you could, and then once you had them separated, you could charge different amounts.
But the Saturday night thing really wreaked havoc on a lot of convention travelers, because, you know, your company's spending a lot of money to send you to a convention that starts on Thursday. You have to stay that extra night, Saturday night, at the hotel.
Right.
Because if you don't do that, you're going to pay a fortune to fly to and from the destination. So even business travelers were often hit hard by that Saturday night rule. Do any of the airlines still have the Saturday night rule?
You know, it's almost completely gone, and that's a very recent development with the Delta fare changes earlier this month. Basically, has eliminated the Saturday night stay. I live in Dallas, and I recently booked a business trip to New York, going up on a Tuesday and coming back on a Thursday. And I used to pay, a company used to pay, $2,000 or more for that trip, and the Wall Street Journal is going to pay $250 for this trip. I was astounded when I saw it. It's historic. And the elimination of Saturday night stay requirements changes a lot of things. It changes how we may vacation. I mean, you can leave on a Sunday and come back on a Friday and have a couple of days before you have to go back to work. I mean, I think people planned a lot of vacations around that Saturday night stay rule as well.
There are many things that the airlines have been trying to do to cut their costs. What are the things they've done, ranging from the smart to the ridiculous?
There's quite a bit of both. We've seen straight up wage cuts at a lot of carriers. It's been very painful for airline employees. Been a great time to be a passenger, except for the baggage disruptions and canceled flights and all that. But from a ticket standpoint, it's a great time. It's been a terrible time, obviously, to be an airline employee. So they've taken pay cuts. Their work rules have been changed. They're working longer. And all of that probably needed to happen. It was an industry that had gotten out of whack economically with labor. The more interesting changes to cut costs are several airlines have essentially been dismantling the flattening out the peaks at their hubs. So instead of a bunch of planes all arriving at the same time and all trying to leave at the same time, they spread the schedule out over the day, over the entire hour, the entire day. That means they can run the same number of flights with fewer gates. They can run the same number of flights with fewer airplanes, and airplanes are very expensive, and fewer employees, and employees are expensive. So that's been a cost savings, and I think that's actually been a good thing for travelers. I think people liked a longer wait at hub airports. You could get something to eat. You didn't have to run to the gate. If your flight was 10 minutes late, it didn't mean you had to sprint through the terminal. So that's been a good thing. Some of the more ridiculous things, American Airlines just recently said they're taking pillows off most of their flights. And, you know, the airline is going to save $300,000 a year or something like that, which for a company like American, a $20 billion company, is sort of a drop in the bucket. You have to wonder, you know, how many tickets they won't sell when just because of the late night talk show jokes and everything else about removing pillows. It just puts the airline in a very bad light, especially when the discount competition is really offering a higher quality product. American doesn't have satellite television. JetBlue does. There are lots of differentiators now where discount airlines are offering high quality service, and to start taking pillows and things off planes is really silly.
One of the things that several airlines have done away with is food, or at least food on most flights. But some of the airlines have started to sell food, so you uh-huh. still had the option of having food. You just had to pay for it. How is that experiment of selling food going?
You know, I think it's going fine. I think people actually like it. One of the fascinating developments in all of that is that the food that they're selling actually isn't so bad. And, you know, airlines had always said, oh, it's so hard to deliver good food. You have all these challenges of trucking it to the plane and the altitude and the this and the that. And gosh, it turns out when you have to sell it, they could actually provide a good sandwich that's not soggy, or a decent salad that's not all wilted. And I don't think travelers have minded a whole lot shelling out $9 for the tuna fish sandwich or whatever the price is, if it's of decent quality. I mean, that's probably what you'd pay at Oban Pan in the airport terminal. So I think, you know, in that regard, it's gone pretty well.
Let's talk about comfort on planes. Now, we talked a little bit about food. One of the most common complaints is the lack of legroom when
yes.
you're flying. And in first class, of course, there's a lot more of it, but it's very difficult to get into first class, even if you've got an upgrade, because everybody else has one too.
And upgrades are going to be harder and harder to come by if they sell more tickets in first class. You're going to have to pay your way to get into the front.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting development. I mean, from an airline point of view, they probably should be selling more of those seats. And by bringing the prices down to reasonable levels, $200, $400, $500 more than a coach ticket, there will be people who will pay for that. And that will leave fewer seats for the Road Warrior upgrades.
What was the differential before?
Oh, thousands of dollars. I mean, nobody bought first class tickets before. But Delta's offering first-class seats at $599, one way. And, you know, that's a price people will pay.
When it comes to seating comfort now, what mm-hmm. direction are the airlines heading in? Are they heading in making the seats more comfortable for the passengers, or saving money by making the seats small with little legroom?
The legroom's shrinking again. And it's hard to believe that it could shrink anymore, but it's shrinking again. American tried a more room in coach campaign where they had decided that legroom had just shrunk to intolerable levels. And they had widened out, taken seats out of airplanes, widened out the space, and hoped that people would pay extra, or, you know, that they could get a bigger share of business travelers and others, that there would be some premium in that revenue-wise for them. Turns out there really wasn't. It's interesting. It's kind of like food, where people complain about the comfort, but they won't necessarily pay extra for it. United does have a program where it has a couple rows on its planes with extra leg room, and they think they're getting some kind of premium for that. If you buy a full fare ticket, you get into Economy Plus, they call it. But by and large, people have never historically paid for that. I mean, there have been all kinds of iterations of three-cabin domestic service, and airlines tried movable rows where you could adjust it for the loads of the day and things like that. And none of it's ever really worked. For so many people, the fare is everything, and they'll change airlines for a $5 difference in the fare. And with fares so cheap and losses so high, airlines have to get as many seats as they can on airplanes these days.
The class system on airplanes is so interesting. If you're a frequent flyer on your carrier, you get to board first. So you make sure you get the luggage space above your seat. You get a better seat on the plane. You get more of an opportunity to upgrade to first class. It's kind of like privileged status, and it's so hard because you're so aware of it if you're a frequent flyer. But I'm wondering how the frequent flyer programs are going to change now that so much is changing about air travel. What direction are they heading in?
I think they have lost a lot of clout in terms of their marketing force. Frequent flyer programs used to be tremendous drivers of loyalty. A business traveler who was building miles on one airline just wouldn't go fly somebody else. And then the fare differential got too high, and you said, well, okay, I can spend $2,000 on this airline or $200 or $300 on that airline. What am I going to do? I'm just not going to spend my company's money, especially if my company's laying off people or squeezing travel budgets or that kind of thing. So loyalty kind of went out that way. And the other way was that airlines made it difficult to actually use miles. So people accumulated huge frequent flyer balances that they really had a hard time using, or at least using for the kind of trips that they wanted. And in that case, the miles devalued. And if you weren't going to get a free ticket to Europe when you wanted to go in the summer, then what good were they? So I think the combination of that, business travelers being in multiple programs, discount airlines having their own programs, everybody's got a program, it's all devalued the frequent flyer program.
Give us some advice. You're going to the airport. You want to check in as quickly and as least stressfully as possible. What's the smartest approach to checking in?
I think the smartest approach is to avoid as many lines as you possibly can. And that means taking advantage of the kiosks, which I think are a great development. You can check yourself in, get your boarding pass, often without standing in line, and that's a huge benefit. I think taking advantage of SkyCaps these days, if you can avoid a line inside the terminal by working with a SkyCap and tipping him a couple bucks, that's worthwhile. I think one of the more important things, if you get to the security line and you see a huge line, don't think that that's the line you have to stand in. A lot of airports have multiple lines, and it's been so erratic that sometimes you can have, a 30-minute, 40-minute wait at one line. A 10-minute walk down the concourse, there's a security line with no wait at all. So it's worth it to take the walk. At a couple airports, Atlanta and Denver have been particular trouble spots. They have central check-in points where it looks like everybody gets herded, but actually each of them have one secondary check-in point. And so even if you have to walk away and, ride the airport train back to your gate or whatever you have to do, that's a good way to reduce stress and save yourself some time.
Yeah, well, here's a great way to add stress. If you take that trip to the line 10 minutes away and it turns out that that line is long, you've just added 20 minutes to your ordeal.
Yeah, that's right. But I think before you take the 10-minute walk, if you're worried about that, ask somebody. Ask at the airport terminal, if there are five flights leaving from five consecutive gates, the gate agents are going to know that, and they're going to know that the other end of the terminal doesn't have any flights or has far fewer flights and likely has shorter lines. People at the airport have to go in and out of those lines quite frequently, and they know how it works. The other thing you can do is check the TSA, the Transportation Security Administration's website, www.tsa.gov. They have some historical wait time data on their website, and you can check by airport, by security checkpoint, and that can give you some guide at terminal B or C or wherever you are of what the different wait times might be that you'll run into.
You write for the Wall Street Journal. You write about travel for the Wall Street Journal. I'm wondering if you think the airlines represent the best or the worst or the middle of capitalism. I mean, for example, it's through greed that some of the silliest airline practices develop, like overcharging last-minute business flyers. And so you could argue that it's through greedy capitalist practices that the airlines are stuck in this position that they're in. At the same time, you could argue that, it's through competition like the discount airlines that things in the airlines are shaking down and prices are coming down and so on. So how do you interpret the role of capitalism in the way the airlines have been heading?
I think capitalism has led to increased travel in this country. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, if you look at where travel was in 1978, before the industry was deregulated, far fewer people traveled and fares were higher. Since 1978, travel has doubled and fares have come down significantly and have declined steadily since 1978. You look at a fare curve since that time, and it is straight down, ski slope. And that's all good for consumers. I think there are some small towns out there that may not have the service that they did back when the industry was regulated. It's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. They don't have the population they did then. Airlines generally go where there are people, and if the town's population has declined, the air service is going to decline too. By and large, there's far more choice at cheaper prices. People can take their families. They can go. Business travelers can get where they want, in a matter of hours. And all in all, it's a better transportation system than when the government ran it.
Do you like flying?
Yeah, I love flying, sick as that may sound.
Why do you love it?
Well, I love travel. I love to see new things. I love to move around. I love the airline industry. There's something about it when, jet fuel gets in your veins or something. It's exciting. It's not, for me, it's not like covering technology or, God forbid, banking or something like that. I'm a pilot myself, and I love that aspect of flying. There's just something very peaceful about being in the air, something enormously relaxing, and there's a great sense of achievement when you can, fly yourself somewhere.
Well, Scott McCartney, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's great to be with you.
Scott McCartney writes a column on air travel for the Wall Street Journal called The Middle Seat. Jennifer Traeg insists that people hate to travel with her. She still has some of the obsessive-compulsive behavior that dominated her life during her adolescence.